Dr. Gary Fraser is from New Zealand. And for many years has worked in the Department of Public Health at Loma Linda, where he has been the principal investigator in the Adventist Health Study. If there is a single person who has influenced the knowledge that we have about lifestyle within the Adventist Church, it is Dr. Gary Fraser. And I have asked Dr. Gary Fraser to come and to summarize, because the data is far too great for him to be able to encompass in the time we have allotted him, but to hit on the highlights and to summarize the way the Adventist Health Study is going. And so it gives me the greatest of pleasure to have Dr. Gary Fraser address us this morning.
Well, good morning. It's certainly a pleasure to be here, and my thanks again to Dr. Handyside for the invitation to come to this beautiful city. What I want to do for a start is to do what Dr. Handyside has just mentioned, but then perhaps to move on from there just a little bit as time allows, and talk about the studies now that you might be surprised to know have been going on for 51 years, supported by the federal government of the United States. And let me at this juncture also take a moment to recognize my co-investigators. I so often present data, but of course I work as a team of people, and one of them is here today, actually. Dr. Joanne Sabate is somewhere in the audience, and certainly these are studies that require the input of many people. You know, the whole business about living longer and the National Geograph and so forth is interesting, but it's not fundamentally, I think, that we're in the business of making centenarians, although that would be rather nice. But more importantly is the fact that the mathematics show that by the choices we make, that we can extend life by about 10 years. Now, for most people, that's actually going to be from the age of about 75 to 85 years. And I'm going to show you that they're probably productive years and associated with a good quality of life. Now, let's see if I can make this go. Right. I'm going to focus today on the chronic diseases, and it's not that I don't believe that lifestyle is important also for the prevention and treatment of infectious diseases and diseases of malnutrition, for instance, but this has been where our research has been, of course, in the United States. Does lifestyle really affect health that much, is a question. You know that it does, but let me show you now a little bit of the evidence about how much, using the California Adventist data. So you can see in this slide here, and I can't turn around and point without losing the sound, but the black line across the middle at 1.0 is the experience of non-Adventists in California with respect to heart disease. The two lower lines at different ages, you see ages changing across here, is the experience of Adventist men and women in California. And so you can see that for both the men and the women, up through the age of 74, 75 years, and in fact beyond, if we were to take it further, that there are dramatic differences, great reductions in premature death from cardiac disease. And in fact, if we put that into numbers, again, if we gave the non-Adventists a risk score of 1.0, you can see there that for the first event definite fatal heart attack and for the first definite heart attack, myocardial infarction, that the Adventist scores for both men and women are around about 0.5, about half. And look at the vegetarians amongst the Adventists. Their scores, as compared to the non-Adventists, are so much lower again. So something important is going on here with respect to cardiovascular disease. If we turn our attention to cancer, and of course I could talk for an hour on each one of these, We find again that if we gave the Adventists, non-Adventists, a score of 1.0, the experience of the Adventists, of course, if we look at the smoking cancers, is just so much less. But if we even look at the other sites, we see that the reductions are dramatic for both men and for women. The Adventists are about 30 to 40% lower in risk of cancers. Now, the whole business of living longer, it's a great boon. And in fact, most of us in this room, many of us in this room, and for generations before us, if our forebears have been Adventists, have probably gained an extra 5 to 10 years of life. What a wonderful gift. And I think it's a gift, however, that comes with a responsibility, and that responsibility is to share it with others. And let me just take you through this slide, which is filled with numbers, probably too many numbers. But the question comes, okay, even Adventist vegetarians don't live forever, but what do we actually die of? I often get asked that. And it turns out that we die of all the same things. And you can see in the first column here, for Californians and Adventists, the percentages of different causes of death. And they're really not so different as compared to the Adventists and the non-Adventists. But whatever they die from, it's at much older ages. And that second and the fourth columns there, if you look at that, this is the age at death from these different causes. And you can see that on average, this is, by the way, all for men, that there's a difference there of about 6 to 7 years of age. So whatever you die from, if you're an Adventist, you die from it 6 to 7 years later. Now, if you take the quotes, the perfect Adventist, so-called, the vegetarian, the one who eats a lot of nuts, the one who's not overweight, the one who is physically active, the one who's never been a smoker. And if you look at those people, you'll find that, in fact, they're living an extra 10 to 12 years as compared to the non-Adventists. So this is a marvelous benefit, I think. And it raises the possibility to me that the way that we live is perhaps affecting the basic rate of aging. What else would affect the age of dying from almost every cause that you can die from? That's a rather remarkable phenomenon, and not one that I expected when I started on this research. Now, one question is, okay, so you live longer. That's not much use unless it's accompanied by a good quality of life. And we've recently looked at some data and got some information about this. This is based on about nearly 11,000 Adventists, and about one-third of them are black and two-thirds were white in this particular study. Now, these, again, are somewhat complicated graphs. You can see on the left side of the graph is the woman, and the right side is the men. The top part is physical health. This is a standard scoring system to look at quality of life. On the lower part is mental health. And the US norms are always the lower line, the more solid line, in each of those four graphs. And you can see that for the black Adventists and the white Adventists, men and women, at virtually every age, the quality of life is higher. And interestingly, even the black Adventists are doing better than the US norms, which of course is largely white Adventists in the population. About 13% of the population are black. So these, I think, are again rather stunning data. So the question, I think, becomes whether this information can really be translated to a non-Adventist community subscribing to a similar lifestyle. And the answer does seem to be yes, as we find all of the same established risk factor disease associations in our data as all other studies have found, the Framingham Heart Study and so on and so on. And Adventists are not biologically abnormal, I don't think. Perhaps you shouldn't look too closely at the people you're sitting next to. But it seems to me that, by and large, we're relatively normal. You know, there's been a lot of talk about genes these days, and how does lifestyle and genes, genetic effects, interact? Probably they're somewhat additive in their effects. And I've just got a little kind of cartoon slide here that you can see the yellow as one gets older, the impact of a bad lifestyle accumulates. Because when your body is subjected to high levels of cholesterol or high levels of radiation or high levels of carcinogens, they tend to accumulate the effects over time. But then on top of that, in the grey, is the effect of the genes. And there's probably a degree of programmed senescence in all of us. The genes just stop working as well as we get older. And you can see the line across there is what I've called the disease threshold, and where the star is, then the combination of lifestyle and genes crosses that threshold and clinical disease becomes evident. What would happen if we had a better lifestyle? And you can see in the middle graph there that the yellow area is the line is less acute, but the genetic effects carry on as usual. And because of the better lifestyle, that person is now living to 70 years rather than 60 years, or in fact the disease becomes apparent at that time. But it's probably even more complicated than that, because it turns out that more recent evidence suggests that the way that we live, lifestyle, what we eat, the way that we exercise perhaps, maybe affects the expression of the genes. Won't change the genes we have, but will affect the way that they're expressed. And so probably a better graph here is the third one, where you can see that the lifestyle is the same as the second one, but there is a better expression of the genes as well. And when that happens, the disease doesn't become manifest until the age of 80 years. I'd like to talk for a moment about the question of lifestyle as compared to medicines and technology, because I was asked to talk about lifestyle as it relates to primary health care. Lifestyle, of course, is important for the prevention of disease, but also for the prevention of risk factors, and sometimes that's being called primordial prevention. And with dramatic changes, in fact, we may treat even some chronic diseases, but the big problem is with maintenance of the change, and that's been talked about a number of times, and I won't say more about that. Lifestyle is very cost-effective, and generally no side effects. Whereas with medicines and technology, we treat risk factors, hypertension, high cholesterol, we treat disease. I'm a cardiologist, I do these things, I prescribe medicines. It's easier to comply with medicines than with changes in lifestyle, but they're very, very costly. Can society really afford it? And although side effects are relatively uncommon, they're sometimes very severe. Let's think for a moment about chronic disease in developing countries. And this is from a relatively recent publication in The Lancet. And it's a reflection, the length of those bars, of the rates of chronic disease per 1,000 people, 100,000 people, in these different countries, if you can read that. And you might be kind of very surprised to look down that list, and these are all generally developing economies or previous socialist economies. And you can see that the arrow down here is the average of the high economy countries, their burden of chronic diseases. Now, does that surprise you? Because it surprised me. If you look at the identity of these countries, Colombia, Mexico, Argentina, and so forth, up to the top, Ethiopia, Nigeria, Congo, and with Russia, you can see that all of them, on average, have a greater burden of chronic disease. We're not talking about infectious disease, than the high-income countries on average. So we have an epidemic of chronic diseases that are becoming established in these countries with developing economies that we need to treat. Another illustration of that, deaths from cardiovascular disease in 1990 and a projection to 2020. And in the non-Western countries, the darker grey, you can see that it is there that the large increases are projected. Now, I might say, just going back to that slide, that many of these events are also occurring at younger ages than the Western countries. The populations tend to be younger. It's a different kind of heart disease sometimes, or it's a mix. In the poorest countries, it tends to be a rheumatic heart disease. And the countries that have developed their economies a little further, It's a mix of hypertensive heart disease, congestive heart failure, and also some coronary heart disease, which of course is partially consequent on hypertension and other causes. Here you can see that if we look in the third row down for the woman and the men, in the total developed countries, the estimated change in ischemic heart disease mortality is an increase of 48%. But look to the second to the lowest row, you can see in the developing countries that the projected change is 137%. So we have epidemics of different kinds, even alongside those with AIDS and others. I think I'll pass this by in the interest of time. And whole countries, of course, are making transitions today from a more traditional way of living in their culture to a more Western way with the calorie-dense, sweet, fatty foods, jobs that don't require very much physical activity with mechanization and so forth. And people with greater flexibility, because their finances have improved, are now able to make choices. The problem is that education and the support from their communities don't keep up with the choices that are available to them, and these choices are often not guided by knowledge about health consequences. Wanted to just mention to you a moment here that I spend about 50% of my time as a clinical cardiologist, spend about 1 week a month in charge of 10 to 25 acute beds in the coronary care unit at Loma Linda University. This is in Southern California, of course. Many Hispanics live there, but there's a dramatic overrepresentation of Hispanics, usually Mexicans in this older age group, that probably fill about one-third of those beds. And these are wonderful, caring, family-oriented people, but otherwise they do not have a happy health profile. And it's in part because these are people that have been making that transition from their younger years growing up in Mexico, now coming to Southern California. Nearly all of those patients have a profile. Before I enter the room, I know what I'm going to find: obesity, hypertensive heart disease, congestive heart failure, diabetes, chronic renal failure, high cholesterol. Maybe they'll be missing one or two. Many of them have the whole lot. And this is the kind of profile that we see time and time again in other groups of people, such as the Maoris, for instance, in the country where I come from in New Zealand, have many of these same problems. So what will it require to change these kind of patterns? Education, of course, but as Dr. Williams said, that's not enough. We need to design programs to wisely use common culturally accepted foods. In other words, to bring those foods into the 21st century, but retaining the positive aspects health-wise. We need people to have access to inexpensive foods. Need to use media, community leaders, iconic figures to lend social support. People won't maintain changes unless they have support from their friends and their community. We need to teach people skills. And also we need the example of respected peers. And I'll come back in a different context to many of these matters in a moment. In fact, these requirements are very similar to those that are effective preventive strategies in developed countries, to the extent that they've ever been effectively tried. And yet, despite decades of lead time, in these developed countries, we are not so far ahead when it comes to risk factors. We just have medicines. Well, I wanted to show you this. One of the things that I'm not going to talk too much about today is physical activity. But it seems to me that as much as I focus on diet, that physical activity is very important. Yet we design our communities very badly, don't we? This is my house, actually, from 20 years ago, and I don't put it up there to show you my house, but I just wanted to point out that I'm not actually having a party at my house, but these five cars out the front just mean that my three teenage kids, myself and my wife, are at home. This is not particularly a slide that I'm proud of. You can perhaps guess which of these cars the young men in the family drive. But the facts of the matter are, they were going to three colleges. My wife was in graduate school. I had a job. And there was just no other way about. Now, 20 years on, we might have five smart cars out there in front, but we really wouldn't have any other choices. That's the way Los Angeles is. It's a disaster. And many of our communities are the same way. Now, I do enjoy coming to Europe and living here occasionally. My wife and I nearly always lose weight because there are many more possibilities for walking and effective public transport and so forth. Well, what about primary health care even in the developed countries? Because I don't think we should overlook them. Can medications and technology, with their huge expense, overcome the great hazards of a poor lifestyle? Is one question. For instance, if we take the example of being overweight, of course it has multiple effects on health. It's related to high blood pressure, to diabetes, to high cholesterol. And did you know it was related to cancer? There's probably 15 to 20% of cancers related to being overweight. Arthritis, of course, and the metabolic syndrome and vascular disease. Well, if we look at data from various NHANES surveys, these are national surveys across the United States at different points in time from the 1960s on the left through about 2000 on the right of that slide, you can see some good things have happened. Blood cholesterols, the percent with high cholesterol have gone down. The percent with high blood pressure have reduced. The percent who are smoking have reduced. But you see, in part, we can explain that by what's been going on with the use of medications. Cholesterol medication in the top row has increased. Blood pressure medication has increased. And I'm not against that. In fact, I prescribe these things all the time, because if you can't convince people to change their lifestyles, you can't wait for 10 or 20 years while social forces change. You've got to help these people in some way, and medications will often do it. But when we look at body mass index, obesity, you can see that that's one thing that has not been changing in a positive way, and we all know that. Back in the 1960s, about 25 was the average, which, by the way, is technically just overweight. And by the time you come through to 2000 and beyond, things have continued to go worse. The average is 28. Do you know that the average non-vegetarian Adventist in our new study, their BMI is 28.4, non-vegetarian? The average lacto-ovo-vegetarian, their BMI is 25.4. It's only the vegans that are down in the 23 range. And look what is happening to diabetes risks. 5% back in 1980, now up to 8%. So as yet, medications and technology, with their huge expense, cannot overcome the great hazards of a poor lifestyle. And I could not refrain from putting this slide up from our new study, which shows, according to vegetarian dietary habit, with the non-vegetarians on the right, starting with vegans, lacto-ovo, pescos, people who eat a few fish, semi-vegetarians, it's like a stepladder going up, isn't it? The risk of diabetes is so much higher, fourfold. And these are all Adventists, by the way. So just let me conclude here with a couple of slides on what I might see as the role of churches as major partners in primary health care. Health can be formed as a religious virtue, and there are many examples of churches that get involved in health promotion, or at least lifestyles that may be associated with improved health. Many Hindus, of course, are vegetarians. It's not totally clear that their form of vegetarian is healthful, however. The Eastern Orthodox, they can spend up to about 20% of their days what they call fasting. But fasting, from their context, just means essentially avoiding animal foods. They become vegetarians for large parts of their life, which is interesting, and this does positively affect their blood cholesterols. The Mormons, of course, are conservative when it comes to alcohol and smoking, and of course the Muslims in very much the same way. So perhaps other religions can also provide effective health leadership. Religion and health are easy partners. And I think it's a fascinating phenomenon that for more than 100 years now, Seventh-day Adventists have been able to become countercultural and behave in ways that have been more healthful but socially difficult in ways that their neighbours have not been successful. And I think that points out the genius of tying some of these things to religion and values. And, of course, churches have some positive attributes in this sense. They're often involved with education. They're often involved with the teaching of skills. They have leaders who can influence opinion. And they also can provide social support for change and maintenance of change. So let me conclude here to just point out once again that the burden of chronic disease in developing countries is huge, it's rapidly increasing, and affects somewhat younger individuals than elsewhere. Lifestyle is a potent potential primary health care force in the prevention of chronic diseases in both developing and economically developed societies. Modern medicine is a marvel but cannot displace lifestyle. It's too expensive and it's often too focused. And I think churches have great potential to influence this situation by providing grassroots health education, motivation, providing personal support, and where necessary, political influence. The Adventists have done it. Thank you.